Begin after six taps. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for listening to the FlixWise podcast. I'm your host and crafter of this episode, Lady P, no relation to Master P. And joining me today is FlixWise co-crafter and frequent guest, Mr. Martin Kessler.
Ni hao.
And maneuvering her way towards the mic in this tiny space is FlixWise's art director and my personal leathersmith, Miss Emma Gerard.
Cheer them on.
Oh my god. Show-offs! Before we do anything, I just want to warn our listeners, do not listen to this episode on an empty stomach, because today's show we're going to talk a lot about making and eating delicious dumplings. If you do not have any delicious dumplings at the ready, I suggest you go and grab some and then come back and listen. Okay, with that warning out of the way, we can talk about today's entry in our Directed by Women series. Martin Kessler is going to tell us why he thinks Liu Jiayan's 2009 feature Oxhide 2 is worthy of the FlixWise favorites list. Okay, Martin, take it away.
Oxhide 2 is a film by Liu Jiayan, who is the sole crew member, director, cinematographer, sound editor, everything. She's the only person making this film, and she also acts in it alongside her parents. Together, they play versions of themselves, who we see make and eat dumplings in real time over the course of a little over 2 hours. And that's the movie. I know that might not sound like much, but I assure listeners that any logline or synopsis will fail to give insight into exactly how cinematic this film is. Seeing well-observed human interactions rich in nuance and meaning in CinemaScope in 9 well-constructed shots, I kind of think that this is what cinema is all about.
Okay. Emma, are you inclined to agree?
I am inclined. It's interesting you say it's what cinema is all about, because sort of your initial impression of this movie is that it's a little experimental, but it is at its core a family drama, and it's like shot in this like epic, you know, cinema format. And
it is indeed. I don't want to undersell how unusual this film is, because you don't often encounter movies that look like this, at least movies that look like this that have this subject matter. I take that back. You don't often encounter movies like this, period. This is a really unusual movie. It's, I would say, extremely minimalist, though I don't know that I have as much experience in minimalist cinema or slow cinema, whatever you want to call it. But the subject of the film is almost not humans, or in its way it is, in a very oblique way, it's about humans. The subject seems to be, when you initially watch it, like about dumpling making, but it becomes clear throughout the course of the film that it actually is about family and human interaction. But, Martin, can you talk just a little bit more about what it is about the film that really appeals to you?
Well, it's sort of interesting. Like, I think sometimes you see this lumped in with slow cinema or similar movement, anti-cinema, and it doesn't really feel like most of those films. Like, typically a lot of those slow cinema movies, they can be kind of austere, and this isn't. I think it's a very sort of warm human experience that it just chooses to get in this kind of elliptical way that you rarely see. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a film I saw screen at the Beijing Film Academy a few years ago, I think probably around the time that it was completed. And it was early in the day, and the film starts, and the only thing I'd known about it was the title and the runtime.
Yeah.
So when the first shot keeps going, I didn't know if it would ever cut. I didn't know what I was in for. I was sort of like, oh no, what did I get myself into? But I think like around the 9-minute mark, there's a moment when the father adjusts a painting on the wall and you sort of realize it was maybe crooked the whole time. Mm-hmm. And I felt like I was in good hands. You know, this isn't a film that was going to close itself off to me or make itself inaccessible. It was actually letting me into this tiny little space. And I think like by the end, you sort of even stop noticing the cuts. There's so few cuts, but it's actually cut on action like you might see in a Hollywood film. And
right,
you become actually really immersed into the environment, into the lives of the people that you're seeing making dumplings. And I think by the end, I had this really sort of intense empathetic reaction to it. And I was sort of like, what did I just watch?
Mm-hmm.
I don't, it stuck with me really, really hard for the past 5-6 years. I keep coming back to it, partly because it does feel so unique.
Yeah.
And like, I think too, it's also like a great palate cleanser kind of a movie. Like, anytime I sort of go and see the usual award dramatic movies, you want drama, you kind of, well, like half the time I feel like I just shook hands with the sociopath. Like there's no real, you know, there's no real personality, or you don't feel like the filmmakers really put their heart into it. And I feel like I need to go and watch this film because it does reflect so much individual expression that I think it's a really incredible film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Emma, what was your experience the first time you saw this?
The first time I saw this and I realized it wasn't a Western and it wasn't a porno.
Yeah.
Well, at first I was really excited because, it opens with him working with leather. And, you know, I'm an aspiring craftsperson and I was super excited because I was like, we're going to watch a movie where we watch like a craft process. And I knew they were going to make dumplings. So I knew we were going to go through that process too. And I thought that was super exciting because that seems to never be the focus in cinema. It's like people, the total opposite that I can think of is like a romantic comedy where the woman has like some high end power job, but you learn absolutely.
Yeah.
She doesn't seem to know anything about her job or ever go to it. Like, yeah, I edit a fashion magazine. Yeah. That's sort of in the background somewhere.
Exactly. Precisely. Yeah.
It quickly became clear that it wasn't really about that. A lot of the action is obscured. It's not a, you know, walkthrough on how to make a wallet and how to make dumpling.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. I think that's one thing I'm sort of misleading our listeners because while the film is about making dumplings, there actually isn't a lot of food porn. There's no glamour shots of the finished dumplings. I feel like I have a good idea of how they made the dumplings, but it's often intentionally obscured, which is puzzling. But I think it's the mise en scène, the way that the scenes are laid out, is really interesting because you often cannot tell what is going on. She highlights interesting things. Like at one point, there's just a giant strainer in the middle of the shot that's obscuring, I think, the father chopping. But it always feels really intentional. It doesn't feel like there's, oops, we accidentally put the bowl in the wrong place.
They bring attention to it, too. Like, I took, like, you know, a half hour or something to figure out that it was, like, not a documentary. Because, mm-hmm. you know, they're like, oh, the clamp's going to be in the way and the lamp's going to be in the way.
Yeah.
Like, it made me think of, like, Albert Maysles wouldn't cover up that he was there in his documentary. So I thought maybe it was like that. And mm-hmm. this was, like, a cultural preservation kind of endeavor. Although in the story, it turns out it kind of is because she doesn't know how to make dumplings.
It appears very, slice of life every day. It was actually rehearsed and staged and prepared months ahead of time.
Mm-hmm.
So everything's obviously very intentional. But let's talk about the use of CinemaScope because I think that's really interesting. I don't know what the exact aspect ratio numbers are. Do you, Martin? I'm so bad with numbers.
It's like, I don't know, 2.1. It's pretty wide. It's a chubby aspect ratio.
Mm-hmm. This is Lawrence of Arabia aspect ratio. I don't know if it's the exact one. Some people are really pedantic about that, and I'm just not. but it's interesting. She said that the CinemaScope is meant to obscure rather than give grandiosity to anything. You're intentionally blocked from seeing certain parts of the frame, I guess.
You can also see more than in life. Like, I don't know, the perspective makes you feel like you're there. Like, you're looking at, like, if you were sitting around the table, you'd be seeing everyone's hands and waists while you were helping make the dumplings. But at the same time, your eyes don't have to move back and forth like they do in real life.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
it is an aesthetic.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's confusing. I mean, the widescreen, at one point, there's a lamp that divides up the frame. And on one side of the lamp, the father's got his cleaver and he's chopping up the meat. And the mother is cleaning the chives. that's the one shot that I really felt like I could see everything. Mm-hmm. But for most of the movie, you can really find your own subject. And even in that shot, you can choose whether you want to look at what the father's doing or what the mother's doing. I mean, there's like a lot to look at.
There is. And some of the compositions are so beautiful. And sometimes just the way it's framed, it does kind of pull your eye to very specific places. Even like in the very first shot, when the work table becomes the dinner table and they move it, it sort of moves into position and you have this negative space that you're waiting for something to fill. And then the title shows up and then you sort of realize that the filmmaker really knows what she's doing. And there's also this kind of 3D effect that you get with just all the layers of objects and things. It kind of gives you this feeling of depth, especially with that, like the deep focus that you get from the digital photography, the small sensor.
Yes, especially that scene that you're talking about where they move the table. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or even just like when they're underneath the table, I really like there's all the legs of the table and you kind of have to see through them. And I think the effect it has is really immersive, actually. It's not typical kind of compositions, but you can see that there's sort of a precision to it and it has a very specific effect.
Absolutely, yeah. I wonder, I was sort of checking myself as I was watching this. I was concerned that a lot of the pleasure that I was getting out of the film was that it's not so much the intimacy, but I think that was part of it, but also like the exoticism. My question to myself was if they were doing something that I was more familiar with, would the movie be as interesting?
I mean, it's funny because I had sort of a different reaction to it. Like, I felt even though I never made dumplings with my family, we would clean mushrooms around the table. And it had this sort of universal quality in that I think made me feel very close to this family in a way that wasn't like you're flipping through the pages of Ethnographic magazine or something like that.
Yeah, that's true. And like I said, the actual dumpling making is obscured. So it's very quickly it's not really about that.
Mm-hmm.
The way that the film establishes that family dynamic becomes very familiar. That's ultimately, they could have been doing anything.
Mm-hmm.
And it would have the same effect, I think.
I mean, I've seen people sort of draw a connection between this film and Yasujiro Ozu's films, where it's the family around the domestic setting, around the table, and that's where the drama happens and the little nuances. And this is sort of a much more extreme kind of stylistic experiment, I guess. But I think you could have a similar reaction watching Tokyo Story in this.
Yeah.
It's like she went, oh, you have a tatami shot? I have an on-the-floor
yes.
shot.
I can go even
under the table.
Tokyo Story is way too action-packed.
Yes, exactly. There's way too much going on here. Whoa. Slow down.
What do you think of... Oh, man, this is maybe derailing, though. I was just thinking there's three characters, and it's, like, that's supposed to be the point in, like, Western drama where, like, irony finally can happen. If you have two people in the scene, they both know what's going on with each other, and it's, like, maybe you get later to, like, you know, Waiting for Godot, where he's, like, okay, maybe we'll switch back and forth between just having two people, or My Dinner with Andre, where it's, like, pushing back against that, but... I don't know. Do you think it's necessary that all three people be there? Or, like, do you think that's an indication that this is, like, a drama-driven story?
Mm.
Like, if it had just been the dad, it really would have just been about Wallace.
Like, also the power dynamic can shift in sort of interesting ways. Like, what's sort of a funny scene is when the father finds the split dumpling and he's telling the daughter, oh, you should have been more careful, and she's saying, that's not mine. And then the mother goes, that's not mine either, it's yours,
yeah.
And sort of pushes it back onto the father. I think you couldn't have a moment like that if it was two people.
Right, right. Or it would have, it would have been more...
argumentative or...
Yeah. Precisely, yeah. It would have been more Godot-like arguing over dumplings. I don't sense a lot of irony. I think... I don't know. What do you think?
Well, I mean, like, you need a little bit of irony to make jokes happen.
That's
like,
true.
The chives part was really funny.
Yeah.
I laugh so much when she brings up the ruler to measure out the length of the chive.
Yeah. Exactly. And we should say that while it's not the most accessible movie, but it is funny. There are definitely moments of humor. There are things that are meant to be funny. I think the funniest moment for me was when Jian is describing the different ways that the way that you make a dumpling is emblematic of your personality. And she's like, if you put too much stuffing in your dumpling, that means you're gluttonous. And the mother very casually says, what if you put too little? Does that make you stingy? You're my favorite. Congratulations.
I mean, that was a big takeaway from the film for me also, is that kind of tension between doing things your way and doing things the right way. And sometimes it comes down to personal preference, whether they want to use the chopsticks to put chives in the dumplings. And I think like that's reflected in the filmmaking too, where you see this great understanding of the formal qualities of filmmaking, but there's also a lot of personality to it too. It doesn't feel like it's done in these sort of classical film traditions.
You're right. This is totally divergent from any sort of classical Hollywood cinema, not only in form, but also in subject.
Yeah. And it's not like a mumblecore movie where it's like there's a lack of attention to the formal qualities where it's like sort of sloppy. Like, this is a very constructed film.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. And it's also like, I feel like mumblecore, like there's this big emphasis on performance and improvisation. Mm-hmm. And there's no improvisation here as far as I know. And there's nothing but Reese's slapdash. This is a meticulous movie, and which makes sense because I think that for me, part of the movie is about craftsmanship. Mm-hmm. And the pride one can take in everyday mundane activities and in everyday work.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It shows it's not always easy either, because the father has a lot of dignity invested in his leather work, and you get a sense that he's somebody puts a lot of effort and originality into his products, but he's also having difficulty with his business, with work. He's sort of worrying that they don't have enough money and that he's not selling enough. There's a lot of pressure. And I guess, like, also the economic national context is in China, because labor's inexpensive, there's a lot of pressure to sort of mass produce things without a high level of craftsmanship or without maybe original mm-hmm. expression. It's more about inexpensive reproduction.
Right. The director has been hesitant to talk about any larger socioeconomic implications of the movie, even though it does seem to be always in the background. But I think it is a celebration of handmade, individual, unique items. And also tradition, that these are not things, the ability to make these things should not be cast aside and should not be underestimated. Part of the movie is also about teaching someone younger about the importance of these traditions and of doing something right, or about at least thinking about the correct way to do it
mm-hmm.
and not to simply do it the expedient way or the easier way. So that was something that I really like about the movie as well. But let's talk specifically about the family dynamic. We mentioned there's a father, there's a mother, and there's the daughter. But what is their interplay like?
It's hard to pin down exactly because they're so it's so natural. Like, they're not like caricatures that are really easy to identify. Oh, this is what the
yeah.
mother's like. This yeah. is what the, you know.
I was trying to establish for myself what the power dynamic within the family is. Mm-hmm. And it seems to constantly be shifting. And on the one hand, one could assume that it's the father because he's the man and that's how these things usually go. But he seems very matter-of-fact about most things, even though he does take the lead in the making of the dumplings. And he's never fetching anything. He's usually the one asking either the mother or the daughter to fetch things. But at the same time, he does seem to defer to his wife, or I assume his wife, the mother, on a number of occasions. And I really did get a sense of her authority within the house. And then there's the daughter, who is often obstinate, but also willing to learn, and often very patient and enthusiastic. The parents are so patient with her. Like, she seems to say really cruel things sometimes, or things that I would not, you know, like, she's very blunt. Mm-hmm. And they don't get offended. They don't get angry. They're just like, they just sort of take it for what it is.
Well, sometimes you do see that, the kind of emotional responses, it's sort of driven more into the subtext. And like, there are moments where, like, when they're talking about the business and you see the father's kneading the dough and he's getting a little bit more frustrated, mm-hmm. It doesn't come out in the way he speaks, but you see it's a little bit more tense, it's a little bit more uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. You get a sense that, to a certain extent, maybe he's embarrassed or at least frustrated.
Right, right. I remember there's a scene where he's chopping the meat and he smashes the cleaver especially hard after the mother says something that seems to hurt his pride a little bit.
Yes.
So the emotions do come out, not necessarily through dialogue or the face, but through gesture.
Yeah, and it's interesting to contrast this with the first Oxide film. I don't know actually if we mentioned this as a sequel, but...
Yes, this is part two.
Yeah, it's part two. And in the first film, it's like it's more on the surface, those kind of tensions. There's actually scenes where the mother slaps the father, or there's a little bit of yelling. Like, it's one thing that makes me prefer the sequel over the first one is that's driven down into the most subtle kind of gestures to let you in on what exactly is going on between everyone in the family.
Exactly. The Oxide 2 is difficult to find. Oxide 1 is even more difficult to find. So if someone would kindly make that available for streaming, that would be awesome, because I have not seen the original Oxide. And I tried to view it online, and it had no subtitles. Which, obviously not a problem for Martin. Who I did not realize. Do you speak fluent Chinese, Martin?
I wouldn't say fluent. I speak a bit of Mandarin.
Okay, that's true.
What a Hanyu sure, mama.
Yes. Yes.
对对对.
Is it a different experience? Do you need the subtitles?
For Oxide 2, I do, because the language that they're using is very sort of plain and simple, and they're speaking slowly. Like, when okay. I'm watching something that's more like an action film or something where people aren't, you know, they're using sort of a vernacular I'm not familiar with, I need to watch it with the subtitles.
Well, most Chinese movies are in Cantonese too, huh?
Yeah, all the Hong Kong stuff, that's a whole other thing.
Like, in Beijing, like, they show Hong Kong TV shows, they have subtitles, because it's, like, really that different.
So... is it a different experience watching it without subtitles? Are we missing out on anything?
I think subtitles might be kind of distracting on a film like this. If that might just add an extra barrier. Like, before, when you sort of mentioned that it did feel a little bit alien to you in some way, that I don't know if subtitles, if there's something in our brain that clicks when we see subtitles that tells us that we're watching something foreign and that this should be foreign to us. And for a film like this, I think its strength is how relatable it can be, or how familiar it can feel.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Eventually you get there. But I will say, subtitles are distracting in a film like this where there's a lot to see within the frame. Mm-hmm. And your eye automatically goes to the subtitles. But that's just a problem that we have to deal with.
Yeah, I think even if you don't understand the language, it might be worth trying just to watch without mm-hmm. the subtitles, knowing mm-hmm. what they say.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
I think also, too, like, did you watch this on a big screen?
40 inches.
Oh, that's pretty good. I mean, like,
okay.
It's pretty different when you see it projected large. Like, it's...
Yeah.
Like, I think that, again, plays kind of a role in it, too, where you see, like, the hands are blown up to being bigger than my body.
Right.
I think that gives a pretty different impression, too, when you can, like, really hyper-focus on the details.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah. Well, let's talk about whether or not we feel this movie is worthy of the FlixWise favorites list. Usually, this question is sort of dashed off at the end. But I really... as effusive in my praise as I've been, I'm not sure if it is canon-worthy just yet. And I will tell you what my hesitation is, and you can try and tell me why I'm wrong. it's... the movie has been seen by too few people. So... I know, you know, someone like David Bordwell says this movie's fantastic. And David Bordwell is an important dude, to be sure. But even... this is not a movie that most mainstream film critics have seen, I would say. So it really just does come down to us and the handful of people who have seen it and our opinion. And I don't know that I have the authority... to canonize a really small movie like this.
Whoa, but it's the FlixWise favorite.
It's the FlixWise favorite.
It's not the Sight and Sound. You don't gotta write to 100 critics and ask them to put it on their top five.
That's true. That is true. But the FlixWise favorites list is meant to... any film on the FlixWise favorites list is meant to be... you're meant to be able to substitute a movie you do not like on the Sight and Sound list and plug in a movie from the FlixWise favorites list.
I would take Rules of the Game out any day.
Okay, so you don't think... you're not as concerned with that.
Well, I think... like, cinema, it's a living thing. I think some people have this idea that movies were a thing that happened from, like, I don't know, 1915 to like 1979.
Yeah.
And I think like it's important to sort of look at where cinema is now, what territory is still being explored, and not necessarily brush off things because they haven't been well regarded yet. I think, you know, we sort of should approach new films with an open mind and open heart. And like clearly the Sight and Sound list didn't have problems with putting movies even newer than this on their list. You know,
sure.
There's some fairly recent films. And, like, I actually think, like, I would take out any of their newer films in exchange for this, because I think this is a masterpiece, a masterwork that doesn't feel like something that's relying too much of what's come from the past. And I think, you know, it'd be cool to shine a spotlight on a film that could be important if enough people do see it.
Yeah.
A big point is usually cultural penetration or influence. I mean, that this film, it's going to be influential for me as a filmmaker or whatever else I do. It's going to be close to my heart, and I wish other people could at least have the opportunity to decide for themselves whether that's the case for them. So I think that's what's cool about having a film canon, is you can make everyone watch good movies.
That's true, absolutely. But okay, so, but Emma, do you have any qualms? First of all, do you have any qualms about putting something that very few people have seen on the list?
Well, I'm not in charge of the list, but I don't.
Okay.
I would rather advocate for this movie to be on the list, because I was just so impressed. Like, I feel frustrated sometimes that I'm watching the same movie over and over again. I don't worry about, you know, narrative cinema and the art of it. And, you know, there's definitely a craft to it, too, being lost. I worry about film having so much potential and being stagnant. And I felt like this movie doesn't just eschew all the conventions. It's very self-aware. It reflects the form back on itself. And it's really kind of clear in the way that it's playing with that. So I feel like it's a really good, like, maybe if enough people saw this, this would be like a transitional movie to something really amazing.
Okay.
But in itself, it's just great to watch. You yeah. watch people making dumplings for 2 hours and it's not boring.
It's true.
So I have no problem with putting this on the list.
Okay, yeah. I mean, it is very similar. The one movie that I would compare it to is Chantal Ackerman's Jean Diamant. Please do not make me say the whole thing. Something, something, Bruxelles. in that it is very... There's like formalist element to it, and there's the same reverence for the domestic space, and it's very meticulous. So there's certainly precedent on the Sight and Sound list for something like this. The question, does this movie distinguish itself enough, and is it ultimately a great movie? I really like this movie. I feel like I haven't seen anything like it. And I definitely want to raise awareness about it. So, I think apparently we just put it in. So, that's cool. So, yay! And that's the way we frame it. Flixwise, that is. Listeners, what do you think of Oxhide 2? Well, first off, kudos for having seen it. That's cool. But secondly, come tell us your thoughts on our website, flixwise.com, or come gather around our Facebook page. It's facebook.com/flixwise. You can follow me on Twitter. The handle is @flixwise. Seriously, if you have seen this movie, I want to hear from you.
Maybe we should mention it's available on Amazon.
Yes, it is available to stream on Amazon. But before you go and rent it, please, 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 go to iTunes, like us, or rate us, and leave us a comment. First things first. Priorities, people. Anyway, on our next show, we've got more slow cinema to parse, though we've determined that Oxhide 2 is not, in fact, slow cinema. But our next Sight and Sound entry is Bellatar's 7.5-hour behemoth, Satan Tango. So we had better get to watching, because it's a long one. It's a lot of film to cover. But until then, Martin, thank you so much for bringing Oxhide 2 to our attention.
Thank you so much for watching it.
Yes, and Emma, thank you once again for coming on the show.
Always a pleasure.
All right, well then let's clear the table.